Hey there. You know, if you're a frequent listener to our show, you already know that our show is brought to you by our friends over at Artillery Sports. But what you may not know is that Artillery Sports helps athletes of all types win on and off the course and court. They do this by selling quality, durable, and precision manufactured sports equipment that keeps you in the game, while also using a portion of the profits to provide the funding needed to care for our nation's veterans. With Artillery Sports, it's more than just a game. So head over to artillerysports.com today to buy the quality equipment you need to keep you in the game and to help our nation's veterans at the same time. That's artillerysports.com. Make sure you head on over there today. Oh, and use the code DOCFIRST to get 10% off your first order.
Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmaking. I'm your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. This week, we are wrapping up our two-part series with Steve Cohen, executive producer of Billy Joel and So It Goes. Last time, we talked about the heart behind And So It Goes, and now we are flipping the spotlight. In this episode, Steve Cohen shares his story, from lighting stages to producing one of the most emotional music documentaries I've ever seen. Trust me, you're going to love where this goes. Now, on with the show.
All right. So everybody, thank you so much. We're back with Steve Cohen. We've been talking so much about Billy Joel and So It Goes, his new film that comes out on HBO July 18th with part one, and part two is the following Friday. It's a don't miss event. We've been talking about the band and Billy Joel and his family and the movie, but we haven't really talked about the behind the scenes and the band. And I really want to start with you, because here you are and we haven't really learned about you. So I'm so curious. Tell me about where you were born and what your family was like and how you got interested in lighting design. And just come on, tell me about yourself.
Well, I'm a West Coast kid. You know, it's funny. Everybody thinks I'm from New York, but I was born and raised out in Canoga Park in California, in Los Angeles. And, you know, I was a theater kid and never went to any classes. So I never graduated high school. I ended up, you know, playing in the theater. And, you know, like all of us, we started bands and played a little piano and you know, was always interested in performing and was always interested in show business. You know, I remember as a kid, I used to cut school and drive into West Hollywood or into Hollywood and, you know, try and break into the studios and watch them making movies. I had a fascination from that from the time I was very, very young. And then, you know, I had a penchant for doing lighting. I worked at a club called the Starwood, which was on Santa Monica Boulevard. I did sound and lights and learned how to drink. And, and I had a particular talent for interpreting music with light. And, you know, in those days, in the early 70s, you know, it's very sophisticated. People nowadays don't realize how primitive, you know, lighting was for music all of those years before all the computerized equipment would come in. It was really all about timing, composition, painting with light. And really, you know, I just loved it. I just loved music. And I felt that this was my way of performing. That was, you know, a way that I could make an impact. You know, I made a decision long before that I wasn't really a great musician, but I had a particular visual acuity and a talent. And, you know, I went with that. I had a gut feeling about all of that. And I think I told you earlier, like my first, you know, I started a lighting company when I was 20, and my first client of note was Billy Joel. Actually, was our first client. We had one lighting.
So how'd you meet him?
We cold called. I started a lighting company, and we cold called every manager on the back of the Billboard magazine. In 1974, Billboard would come out at the end of the year, and in the back cover was a list of every manager and their phone numbers. Remember, this is before fax. This is before computers.
Right.
So we started this lighting company, me and a couple of guys, and we sat and dialed and smiled and, you know, told them, you know, gave him a bunch of bullshit to try and get meetings. The day that I met Billy's manager at the time and his sound engineer. My partner had met with the guys who did Earth, Wind & Fire, and we came back home and said, hey, I got Billy Joel. And he said, hey, I got Earth, Wind & Fire. And we were like, well, we have one lighting system and two clients. So I had to go and rent some gear and put together a very cheap and cheerful lighting system and get ready to go in rehearsals with Billy. Now, what I will say is I was a California guy. So I was like way into the Eagles. I was way into Linda Ronstadt. I was into progressive rock like Jethro Tull and, you know, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and all of that stuff. And Billy Joel, Piano Man, had come out and it just wasn't my particular flavor. I just didn't like it. It wasn't a great song. And I was like, well, I don't know. Okay, fine. I guess I got a gig. And I showed up at rehearsals. And the band at that time was Billy, a bass player, named Doug Stegmaier, a pedal steel guitar player named Tom Whitehorse, a drummer named Reese Clark, and a guitar player named Don Evans. And we were in the studio and I set this lighting system up and I'll never forget this. They started to play the Ballad of Billy the Kid. And all of a sudden I heard this orchestral depth in an arrangement and this dynamics. It sounded like a Western movie mixed with a rock and roll record. Yeah. You know, I knew that it had some pretty good rhythmic stuff, so I could do some lighting with it. And I left rehearsals. We'd done a few songs, and I walked away going, this is something beyond my imagination. Like, it was something I had never heard before. And I went out on the road interpreting that music with lighting, you know, in 1974. And it was like, you know, you look at those things that happen in your life, and, you know, how you get brought to a particular place at a particular time that changes your life. I don't know what was in all of that, but I do know that those couple of weeks were life-changing for me.
Well, I hear a theme. I mean, so I was in theater too. That's how I started. All I wanted to be was an actress. And I was on Long Island. So I went to the Stony Brook School. I lived in Stony Brook and it's just home to me. And I started acting there. And when you are there, it's all about the story. Yeah. It's all about the story and lighting is a crucial part of that. And so when you're listening to Billy the Kid and you're hearing this, you know, story, and that's all through Billy Joel's music, you can interpret the story with lighting. And yeah. So all of a sudden you're not just, you know, lighting a band, you're actually telling a story with lighting, which, right. You know, is very similar to theater. So that probably in the back of your head was like, oh, I recognize this. I can do this.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons Billy and I developed this relationship was because he knew that I saw that in the music. I heard that in the music, and he saw that I saw that. And you know, you don't think about that at the time. You just put your head down and do the work. But now, you know, with the reflective, you know, time between, you know, then and now, you know, what you point out is exactly correct. That, you know, he's a storyteller. I'm a storyteller, and we met each other at the right place. And I don't know if I even was aware of any of this stuff throughout the decades, because, you know, we just showed up and worked. That's all we did, is we just worked.
But how did you, because there were so many over, I mean, it's been 50 years. There've been so many that have come and gone. Yeah. So how have you lasted? What has kept you in the band this long?
I'd like to say it's because I'm good at what I do, and Billy recognizes that I'm good. I also believe that I have a particular work ethic that reflects his work ethic. I also knew to keep my mouth shut. I also never got too full of myself in what I did. Like, I accepted the responsibilities as they were presented to me, but I never really, you know, tried to bite off more than I could chew. I also, you know, it's a tough bunch of guys. Like, we were all pretty tough on each other.
Yeah,
and we were all we were all, you know, you never stepped out too much out of your own lane. But if your lane expanded and you grew to it, Billy was the first guy to say, yeah, go ahead and do that. I mean, he's a great boss. I think that the main reason that I've stuck around this long is because I love him, and I have done nothing throughout this period of my life but show up for him in the best possible manner. And I think he recognizes that.
Yeah.
You know, it's also a little different for me. You know, I'm not a player. So, right. You know, I was able to shift and expand and grow in my role with him. I think that, in a lot of cases, the relationship between musicians has a sell-by date. You know, there people have to grow, producers right. have to grow. Right. You know, when it comes to that actual art form, you have to make changes in order to grow. And, you know, who knows why people come and go. There's a lot of different reasons that we've had. When we did the credits for the film, part of the thing that I put forth was that I wanted to list, we were talking about how to list the musicians. And I said, well, we have to list all of them, every single band member that's played with the band. Yeah. And at the end of the film, there's 56 names, you know, and they're not in order of appearance, but they are, you know, sort of chronologically. And it's all because when you're a musician, I believe that you need to introduce lots of different colors in the way you produce that film, produce that music. You know, with me,
yeah.
I don't know. I think I was able to grow a little bit. And I'm, you know, I think, you know, I think I'm actually kind of okay to be around. So it's like not, you know.
I like you.
The other thing I can be honest with you about is that I kind of know when it's time to leave the room. And I think that's one of the things that makes me, you know, that makes anybody successful in a professional relationship is,
true.
Knowing when to shut up and get out, you know, and I think that's, you know, I try never to overstay my welcome. So,
well, this is a podcast for learning. People, you know, I hope do learn things when they listen. And right there, you gave a long list of things that I think people should write down. It's a good list to learn from. I mean, if you do want to last in any creative relationship. And I do think you're right. Your role in particular was, easier than the others to stay because you were not necessarily, you know, in the band and trying to make it to another level. You also weren't taking anything from Billy.
Right.
You know, you didn't really need to get anything from him. You were doing a lot of giving. You were, it seems to me a very giving person. You were a very supportive person. You were there to make him better, right?
I was there. I was there very specifically to take the what he gave the audience and give it a visual component.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then that just evolves, and that just grows. You know, I mean, yeah. I thought all of those early videos. I directed all those early videos before MTV. You know, I came into play. So like the earliest stuff was like, well, Steve. You know, Steve knows how to do that. So let him do it. Like Billy was not the kind of guy to search out and say, go find this director to do this stuff. Because number one, he hated to be in front of the camera. Number two, he never really wanted to have a visual example. And this is where Elizabeth became very, very important in all this stuff, because for promotional purposes, you know, before MTV, the only people that were doing music videos were the Europeans. So, you know, she wanted to break him over in Europe. And the way to do that was to, you know, do video of performances or conceptual videos or whatever you want to talk about. So, I did all of that stuff up until the Nylon Curtain. When the Nylon Curtain came out, that's when MTV started. And that's when Billy, you know, worked with Russell Mulcahy and did those three videos for the Nylon Curtain. Then, of course, John Small did the famous Uptown Girl and that period of time. Tell her about it. But, You know, I did all that early stuff because it just fell to me. It was like, hey, I'll do it, you know.
Well, I mean, what's interesting, you know, you kept saying you kept growing and yes, you did the early things, but I mean, your career since then, you're not just a lighting guy and you didn't just do the early videos. I mean, come on, you've got a long resume now of doing a lot of different things and you've got a lot of things coming up. So talk to me about all those things. Like, how did you get all this other experience?
Well, I mean, the touring stuff begat more touring, which begat larger, you know, I became a set designer, I became a production designer, I became a creative director. You know, I did a lot of stuff. You know, you stick around long enough, you know, you end up crossing paths with a lot of people. I did the first NSYNC tours. And when Justin and Brittany were going out, I ended up doing the Brittany tours. And, you know, I did the Eagles and Elton and there were many, many opportunities. Wow. They all came from, you know, initially the door was open with Billy Joel, but, you know, 10 years into my relationship with Billy, I was working with a lot of different artists. And then, you know, as that developed, I started to do lighting for television. I started to do lighting for comedy specials, you know, and the nature of my career, you know, developed. One of the things I think, you know, going back to the Billy thing, one of the reasons I think I stayed with Billy as long as possible is that I had another career, and he really enjoyed my successes outside of Billy. He didn't feel responsible for me all the time. He didn't feel right. Like I was a burden for him. So, you know, I was, you know, he got a kick out of me calling him, telling him that I'm in a rehearsal with Mariah Carey in the middle of Tokyo. And, you know, he liked me having that window into the other world and reporting back. And so all that was good. And then, you know, as it developed, you know, my first documentary that I produced was Last Play at Shea, which was the documentary. And how that came about was, you know, we were doing the last two shows at Shea Stadium. Billy wanted to, you know, was being approached by a bunch of documentary filmmakers and he was frustrated and he just handed me a whole folio of people. He said, you pick, you know, basically if you want to do this, why don't you do it? It was sort of an abdication of him not wanting to have the responsibility. Okay. And then I ended up producing that film with, you know, with Glenn Zipper and Nigel Sinclair and Paul Crowder and Mark Munro. And then from that point on, it then fell to me to do all the television projects. So, you know, now I'm, you know, in development with, you know, four or five other TV projects and, you know, I'm doing some with Billy and some by myself. But, you know, someone was saying to me the other day, it's like, are you really itching to do stuff, you know, outside of Billy Joel? And I'm like at this place in my life where I'm like, I don't really care. Like, you know, there is nothing wrong being attached to the mothership. Like to me, you know, having him as a mentor, as a collaborator, as a friend, I know that for example, I have a very good friend of mine who has written two books, who's honored me with the rights to develop them for television. Mm. So I have these books and I talk to Bill and I say, hey, you know, read this book and let me see what you think about this and that. So there's a collaborative a part of our relationship that I hope just keeps going on and on and on, you know, regardless of whether or not he, you know, sings Piano Man again for all care, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think too, you know, as we get older and I am older, you begin to realize that time is finite.
Yes.
And I think, you know, too, as he's announced this new thing that he's dealing with, I want to hang on to him as long as I can.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean, my bucket list since 2014 was to see him in Madison Square Garden. And I never got there. There's a whole bunch of reasons, but one of the big ones was because I was working on my film and I was in France all the time in the summers. And so I just could never get there. And it's one of the biggest sadnesses of my life that I never got there.
Right.
And I hope he does sing again. If he ever does sing again, I will fly to Tokyo. I will fly wherever, you know, I hope he does sing again. Because
I will tell you, like, you know, I go to sleep at night, and I go to sleep at night with two wishes. My one wish that I've thought about for years is like, what would I do if I won the lottery? And the second wish is the triumphant return to center stage at Madison Square Garden. So we're on the same page. You know,
can you please, if that happens, if it's even in
you're coming. If it happens, you're coming.
I mean, seriously.
I don't cut him. And listen, I do not cut him out of this world. You know, there's part of me that knows him so well that if he's able to do it, you know, he can't stay away. You know, like there's a part of him that just, you know, loves that.
I just keep hoping that. I keep thinking, you know, like I keep thinking, I pray. I actually been praying about it because I keep thinking this can't happen. He can't, I just can't have missed this opportunity. You know, I wanted to do that before I died. It was in my bucket list. How can that just stop? I mean, I never thought it would stop.
Right.
You know, when he announced that it was going to stop, I was like, what? Like, he can't stop. He's the Energizer Bunny. Like, that can't happen.
Well, it's funny. Tom Hanks said something on the red carpet the other day. He said, you know, people set their calendars to when they're going to go see Billy Joel.
And, yes.
You know, we were only doing two shows a month. But we were doing two shows a month every single month.
Yeah.
So.
That's why I thought it was just so consistent. Yeah. And I wasn't in a rush. Like I thought, oh, I don't have to rush. And I mean, I have plans with friends in New York and I've made them like the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, every year something comes up and I'm like, well, you know, we'll do it next year. I mean, and so this past summer it was the closest. And then, so you have to call me.
Yes. Yes, I will. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Listen, and you can tell him I pray for his health. And, you know, it's even harder now that I've watched this documentary because he's so self-revealing. You just feel like you know him at the end.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like you're part of his family.
I'm really, really happy that's your takeaway from this because that tells us all that we've done our job, that Susan and Jessica have done their job. And you know, listen, he says it at the end of the film, you know, I'm not done. I'm trying.
And I know he does say that, you know, and that's what I love about him. Like, you know, the thing that's so great about him is that you guys talk about how he's always fighting for something, you know, always grasping, you know, it's never enough. He's always, you know, fighting and it's true. And we all are. That's the thing, you know, if you wanted to go to one thing in his music, it's that, yeah. You know, it's that we're all grasping. We're all trying to grow. We're all trying to get to know our parents better, right? Yeah. We're all trying to understand ourselves better. We're all trying to figure out why our relationships broke or, you know, we're all trying to love the people in our lives better. You know, we're all trying to leave something for our children so they won't forget us when we're gone, you know? I can't air this podcast.
But you know, you know what's great about this? And I'll tell you, as much as, you know, as much as it's raw, like this is life. This is the thing. This is what we're here for. You know, feeling our feelings and experiencing them and sharing them is the biggest gift any one of us can give.
You guys did just such a great job. And this is going to touch so many people. You know, I was watching all of those people, you know, just, I mean, lying all over the stage. Like, I couldn't believe this is like back in the 80s when they were so close to the stage and he's standing like right at the edge. Like, that would never happen today. And I just couldn't believe it. And it's like this alligator's arms, you know, all over the place. And I just, and then you look at Madison Square Garden or all these other places and you think about, like, I was just in Normandy. Okay. So I took this veteran that's 102, C.O. Bauer. He's in my film. And in Normandy, you take these World War II veterans back and these people, these French people are so grateful for their freedom. It is like they are Billy Joel. Yeah. Like, it's like they're Elvis. It's like they're Jesus. They just want to touch the cloak. They just want to touch them, you know, and it reminded me of that. And I was on stage with him for this event, and I looked out and there were just thousands of French people out there, and it was nothing compared to what I saw in that Billy Joel film. Mm-hmm. And when I was on stage like that, I was so overcome with that amount of people and just how moved they were just to see and hear this veteran. And I just can't imagine. Now I know why Billy does it. I mean, he's giving people something of himself. Like, how he, you know what? He wore a jacket. This is hilarious. From the time that he started, he would wear a jacket, and he still wears a jacket when he plays piano, and he's sweating like crazy because he gives every ounce of himself. I mean, he just is going to pass out at the end of a concert because it's like he leaves it all on the field. Yeah. And he does it for these people because he loves them.
Yeah.
You know, he wants them to feel what he feels.
I'll finish with this. The thing about the jacket, which is probably the quintessential, I'm glad that you brought this up, is what he wore on stage. Very early on, he would wear this short leather jacket.
Yeah.
And then that went away and he'd wear a suit coat and a tie. And it was like, why are you wearing a jacket and a tie? And he'd say to me, because the audience paid money, I could at least give them a little bit of respect.
Uh-huh.
And that has been, that's why he has worn that.
I wondered.
Career was simply because if you're going to go spend money to see me play, I got to show you a little bit of respect.
Wow.
And dress up. And you know, it became a convenient style guide for him because it's easy. He didn't have to chase trends, although he did have some wacky jackets, the orange jacket we used to call the Beast. but it was always that. And I think that is the quintessential Billy in that, you know, he always said to me, you show up and work. Like, that's what you do. If you're going to be a bus driver, be the best fucking bus driver you possibly can.
Yeah.
Like, that's what this is about. Because at the end of the day, that's all you got. And that isn't false humility to me. That is what I define as humility, that it's an accurate assessment of your place in the world. And Bill taught me that when I was 20 and he was 25. I don't know where he got it from, but it was somewhere, you know, knowing his history.
Let me just say this, especially given his upbringing.
Exactly. Because
truly, like, he doesn't have those role models in his life to teach him those kind of ethics.
But he figured it out, and he figured it out in some way, you know, and I think it's because he always believed his talent was a gift and nothing ever to be taken for granted. And also nothing, you know, never really wanted to get under the hood to understand why. Because he always thought that the magic would be, you know, dissipated. Like, mm-hmm. you know, if I figure it out, then I'm going to know too much and it's not going to happen. There's a certain mysticism and you know, spiritual quality to, you know, to the way he approaches all this stuff. I mean, he's not really that much of a spiritual guy, but I think that there's a through line of miracle in his discoveries. No question. And I took from that. You know, listen.
Well, I'm a very spiritual person, and I believe there is a creator that gives gifts, particularly when I see someone like Billy and like you. And truthfully, I was sitting here thinking, we've been talking a lot about Billy, we've been talking a lot about you, but there are so many other people that made this film.
Yes.
Whether it was, you know, Tom and Gary, or whether it was Susan and Jessica, or whether it was all the people behind the scenes that we haven't even mentioned. Yeah. I mean, there are color correctors. The color was beautiful. The editors were amazing.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, James Pilott and Stephen Ross and Chris Lime. I mean, you know, listen, I think it's so amazing to watch you know, that participation, because really at the end of the day, you know, you are, you know, this, you are at the behest of your editors. They get a rough cut, and that you see, they see something in what you shot that you never even saw.
And but also, how hard do you know? I mean, I'm sure you do. You made this, but I mean, people out there don't know how hard it is for sound designers to do a rock biopic documentary. Like, it is, sound is really hard for a documentary like this. And I mean, sound was amazing.
Well, to you know, because this is a podcast about filmmaking, like, that's a real important point that you brought up. One of the things that we did was, and this was, you know, part of the things I'm so proud of is, you know, Brad Lee, who was the engineer for Phil Ramone, who made, you know, 52nd Street and Nylon Curtain and Songs in the Attic and Glass Houses. You know, he was responsible for the Dolby Atmos re-releases of these records that went on Apple about 3 or 4 years ago. And we brought him in to take every one of these tracks and mix them for 5.1, mix them in 5.1 so that the film had authentic 5.1 Dolby tracks, as opposed to an ersatz mix where you would just sort of make it sort of spatial. He did all of that. He created all the instrumentals. So he stripped Billy's vocal from the original
track. I mean, you're basically redoing sound for this.
So really, it was part of the deal that I had said when we were going to do this from the beginning, is that the sound and the audio quality, if we're going to take this, it has to be, you know, it has to be it has to be the best. So he came in. The other thing we did was, there's about 4 or 5 pieces of music that are score that were written and produced by Tommy Burns and Tony Bruno.
Okay.
Tommy is a guitar player. Tony is his collaborator. And they took and did reinventions. Susan had an idea when she did the Ancestor section that she wanted Vienna to have a score. She wanted Vienna to be a baseline for a score. She wanted it to feel.
I remember that.
She wanted it to feel a bit more sort of Eastern European. And so she tasked them, she commissioned them to write.
Great.
Pieces. They took pieces of Laura and Rosalinda's Eyes and Souvenir and rearrange them, reframe them to underscore part of the Roz's story and part of Billy's story. So musically, I think this film is so well defined and so well executed because of the time involved, because of the work that you know, Susan and Jessica, we all just sort of you know, we really put the hammer down, all that stuff. I mean, you know, it
was, I mean, it just definitely a huge collaborative effort from people who put all the heart and soul in that. And they, you know, they wanted to make it the very, very best. And, you know, I want to say hats off to all the people who were willing to be vulnerable, you know, the ex-wives, the ex-band members, the, you know, the children and the stepchildren. And just, there was just so many people who were willing to step up for Billy to make this film. And it is not easy to do that because it lives forever.
Yeah.
I hope that it was a healing thing, perhaps, you know, because it just was for me watching it. I was thinking a lot about my own stuff. So that was very special to watch. And I was just, you know, very thankful for that. Is there anything that, you know, you would like to talk about? Anything that happened, anything that you were really proud of, anything that nobody ever asks you that you want to talk about?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the thing that comes to the top of my mind for me is, you know, you spend your life living your life and working and showing up and doing the best you can, and you never think that you get an opportunity to watch it play back in front of you. And, you know, that Billy trusted me to be the gatekeeper, that he trusted me to be the shepherd, told me about a relationship that even I didn't understand.
And, you didn't know you had.
And I think the most astounding thing about this is that we've gotten here. So many times I thought the plug would be pulled for some reason or another. And that I was able to learn about myself and learn about Billy in ways that I never anticipated that it would happen. So like I pinch myself. You get really, these kind of opportunities don't ever present themselves. And what that does for me is it motivates me to try and share this with other people so that I can tell them all you need is a bit of reflection and you too can have the grace that comes from this kind of process. The friendships that I made, look, I'm 71 years old.
No, you're not.
I'm too old to have new friends. We have friends. Like I have now in the past 4 years have relationships that are going to last the rest of my life that I wish I'd had for the past 30 years because of this project. Yeah. I mean, it's a testament to Bill, but at the end of the day, I'm a pretty lucky guy. And I think that's the thing. If there's anything I can take forward is, we're all of service. We're put on this earth to be of service. So by being a part of this movie, and I'm just a part of this movie, this is not my movie. I did not make this movie. I was a soldier in an army that helped march this army to a victory, to a goal. I helped Susan. I helped Jessica. I supported them. I gave them gateways into things. I had a draft of a memoir that Billy had written that I had the only copy. And
wow.
I was like, well, Bill, I think there's some good shit in here, but you gave it to me. And he's like, I don't remember. So I opened that up and gave that to Susan. So I was
Oh, is that where did the handwriting things come in? I loved that technique.
That's how he writes lyrics. Those books were all that he always wrote in a longhand spiral notebook.
So he still has those notebooks?
Oh yeah. No, those notebooks are all all in storage. Yeah.
Oh man. I hope those are in a museum at some point. Cool. Yeah, where they, I loved whoever did that. I mean, those,
graphic,
I'm sure,
right.
Jessica graphic. And Susan, but they, the, and let me just give a shout out to the ARC producers, because those are the archival and clearance producers, because the archival stuff in here and the way that the directors used those, it was brilliant. It was just engaging. It kept you wanting to lean in.
It's interesting. The Pentimento team, first of all, they're all women.
I love that. Yay, women.
They're all women. Katie Ash, Sydney Kalpas, they are all, the archive producers, they were involved, knee deep. John Jackson, who used to be at Sony for 22 years, came on as our own archivist for Billy. We've just brought him on board a couple of years ago. He's one of the archive producers, and we both, we're in the boxes, pulling stuff out, saying this is a better version of this, this is a better version of that. And in the process, we've discovered footage that I didn't even know we shot. I just got a rough cut of a concert that we shot in a club in Long Island in black and white that I only thought we shot three songs that I now... I've got a rough cut of about 12 songs. So, because of the process. So, it was tremendous. And listen, this is not a, HBO, I got to give a big shout out to HBO. They wrote a big check. And this was a properly funded, justifiably funded documentary.
Did it take 5 years? Like how long did it take?
About 4 years, really.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and really, honestly, that's quick given how big this task is. I mean, this is 51 years of a man's ginormous career. Yeah. I asked Alexa to list for me how many albums Billy Joel had. And I think it was like something like 146 or something. And I was like, what? I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Oh, and I learned that he did write a classic piece called Fantasies and Delusions.
Yeah, classic. It's a classical album of you know, I mean, and it was number one on the classical charts for 12.
Didn't even know that.
Yeah. See,
I thought I knew everything I could about Billy Joel. I learned so much in this film. Listen, truthfully, all the people behind the scenes that nobody knows about, you know, the art producers, the, you know, sound guys, the, you know, all of them, please tell them what an amazing job I thought they did. And, you know, I know how much of a collaborative work it is. I know that everybody poured their soul into this because it wasn't just to make Billy look good. I think that everybody knows this is a big family, and it's not just his story. It's our story. And it's the great thing about Billy. He invites everyone into the story. You know, one of the pictures I loved is in the very beginning, Elizabeth talks about this, and there's a name for you guys. She said, all of a sudden you became this big something. It's like a meme.
Oh, we're the Meme Brothers.
Meme Brothers. What does that mean?
I don't know. We just had an attitude. We were tough.
Oh, we in were, the A-N. Yeah, in and, the A-N.
Yeah, we were mean. We were just mean. We were like, you know, we were just mean guys. And in fact, we weren't. We were all a bunch of sweethearts. But we like to profess that we were like, oh yeah, we're tough, you know.
Yeah, so yeah.
It was the Mean Brothers. There was me, MB1, MB2, MB3, MB4, and then Elizabeth was Queen Mean B.
So, yeah, I mean, he made this family, and he stayed with his family. I mean, how many of you guys are still close? How many people kind of stayed in the family?
Ones that are still alive, we're all close. I mean, we're not close, but we. You know, it was great reconnecting with everyone. I have this connection with all those guys in the original band because I was there with them at the beginning. You know, they're not there. I still am. So when we needed them for the film, I was the guy who reached out to all of them. So, you know, and I think it's been a great opportunity for all of us to reconnect.
Tell Liberty I loved him. Like, I just loved him. I loved watching the evolution of him as a man, like boy to a man, and just the way he looked. He looks really cool now, by the way. You can tell him I thought that. And I just loved how he, you know, was butthurt, but then came back. And, you know, I loved how he said, you know, I'll play for you anytime, but, you know, tell what's his name. I don't remember his name.
Right.
Yeah. I'll never play for him again. I just thought he was the coolest. And I mean, you guys listening, you have heard so much right now that you can learn from. You have been in the business for a long time. And, you know, you didn't finish high school, but you got a master's. You got several master's degrees over the course of your life. It is stunning to me what you have accomplished in your life. And, you know, not just in what you can do, but I mean, I'm listening to you. I've gotten to know you over this time, and I hear the depth of your knowledge of people. And no wonder Billy loves you like he does, because you do equal, you know, I see you have the same heart and understanding of people and care. I mean, if you're going to stick around like that, you have you do mirror him. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I love talking about this, and you brought out stuff out of me that, like, Susan brought out of Bill. So I
really, it's my job.
I really appreciate it. I can't wait to hear what you cut this show up into. And
there's no cutting.
This is live. This rolls the way it is.
This rolls the way it is. We'll cut the little pause out just a little bit, but I'm going to roll it from the beginning, and
I can't wait. And I think that it's a service that, you know, if we've had the opportunity to educate and to share experiences and inspire people to go make good work, I think that both of us did what we needed to do here. So,
yeah, I think so too. We'll probably divide it up into two podcasts now, because we've talked for an hour and a half. And I think it's just been delightful. I've learned so much. This has been an opportunity of a lifetime to meet you. I wish I could be your friend forever. It's just, you're an amazing man. And I thank you for what you've taught me since I was 13 and what you've taught me in this podcast. So.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And I can't wait for people to see the movie. And, you know, we're not done yet. Just like Billy says, we're not done. We got lots more to do.
Well, Samantha has my email, and yes. I'm going to send you my phone number and my and listen, you know, well, we'll talk when I hit end. But anyway, all right. Is there anything else? Oh, let me do like a quick, we're supposed to ask people. I have a special segment of my podcast. So hang on 1 minute. We're going to do my special segment. It's called DocuView Deja Vu. Do you have a documentary that you would like to recommend to our audience?
Yes.
Go on. Shoot.
Well, I have two. I think The Kid Stays in the Picture is one that has resonated with me forever. It's about Bob Evans. And I think the problem is? I don't think that's a doc. I think it might be a narrative.
That's okay. That's okay. We we fudge things here sometimes. So it's okay.
I will get into an argument with my friend Susan Lacey about this. But I think that the Frank Sinatra documentary will always stand as.
I can't believe you said that.
I love the fact that there's no talking heads in that film, and it's all done audio wise.
Yeah.
I think that was probably one of my favorites. I'll tell you the other one that I just saw that I really liked was Barry Average's David Foster documentary. I thought that was a really interesting thing because I thought David was very, very raw in all of that. And he got him to be completely honest.
Yeah.
And then my fourth, which is probably the number one, is of course my friend Susan Lacey's Leonard Bernstein documentary. I think that is far and away one of the most superior artist documentaries. That probably goes on the top of my list.
Yeah, she's amazing. That is a fantastic one. But I will tell you that Frank Sinatra documentary, it's just as long as yours. I mean, if not longer. And I have watched that. I've watched that. When I watched yours, I thought the same thing I think about Frank Sinatra's. I watch it all the time. And it's crazy. I don't know why, but I just could watch it over and over again. And his is linear, but it kind of doesn't matter. I just love it. And yours is the same way. I thought, you know, this is a kind of documentary that I'm going to watch over and over again, because I just love the story and the music is there.
For me to be in the same, for us to be in the same world as Frank Sinatra, that's mission accomplished.
Yeah, well, you're there in my book.
Please let's stay in touch. All right.
Yeah. All right. Now don't go away. I'm going to click stop recording, but don't go away. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.